This is Jim Inkster. Coming next on the show, we are slated to hear from Edwin Washington Edwards. He was governor of Louisiana for 16 years and is trying to go back to Congress 50 years after he first arrived. And we, of course, will strive to talk with all the six district candidates. And Edwin Edwards is the one who is best known and the most prominent Democrat in the field. Also on the show, Thomas Miller and Albert Samuels, slated to be with us. They are members of the Southern University Faculty Senate. President Ron Mason was on this show a few days ago, and the Faculty Senate was not impressed with his remarks. At least these two members were not. We'll find out why. And Bob Jacobson, who is president of the Louisiana American Society of Civil Engineers, celebrating their 100th anniversary. Now the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your local number. Outside the area, it's 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org, and you may reach us online. That's how you reach us online. You may tweet us at Jim Inkster Show. Today is the 6th day of August, so we are inside 3 months before the November 4th election. And tomorrow is a big day for our first guest. The man who was born on 8-7-1927 turns 87 tomorrow. Good morning, former Governor Edwin Edwards.
Good morning, sir.
Good to hear your voice. You're sounding strong.
Well, it's been some time since we talked. I enjoy talking to you, and you have an interesting group of listeners out there, so maybe we can do something to get their attention.
Well, campaigning agrees with you, doesn't it?
It does. It's kind of comes second nature. It's just like a dentist or a doctor or a lawyer or a farmer or a laborer of any kind who loves his job. I love mine, and I love being with people. I love serving them, and it's the way I think that I was meant to be.
You're running in a district that forecast by Charlie Cook, the prognosticator from Shreveport, who, of course, is the big guy in Washington, is the 15th most conservative district in America. How can a guy like Edwin Edwards win in a district like this?
I think because although it's a conservative district, and I acknowledge that, I don't have any liberal, socialistic-type views on government. I believe government should serve people and take care of those that they need. But on the other hand, I think it should provide the environment for people who wish to get in business and the professions and to pursue their way of life. And that's a rather conservative attitude. And I'm conservative in the sense that I don't think government should interfere with people's private lives, getting their bedrooms and telling them what to do and how to live their lives, what church to go to, what religion to practice. That's the American way, and the American way is to let people do what they feel like doing as long as they're not interfering with somebody else's rights. And that's my attitude. So to me, it's not a question of Republican or Democrat. I'm married to a Republican who's a wonderful lady, and I don't have any problems with Republicans generally. I think some of that right-wing Tea Party attitude towards government is not good for this district because we are farmers and laborers and teachers and people in the professions, and government needs to be supportive rather than always getting in the way and creating problems for people.
Well, today in the Advocate, there are 8 candidates listed and money raised. You're the only Democrat, 7 Republicans, and you say you don't want to get in people's bedrooms, Governor, but my guess is if I were to ask any of these 7 Republicans if they wanted to overturn Roe v. Wade, the Supreme Court decision that gives women a right to have an abortion if she chooses, that's been on the books now for 41 years, all of them would say, yeah, I want to overturn it. What would you say?
I think we need to be practical and recognize that the court has visited and revisited Roe v. Wade a number of times in the 30-some-odd years since it was first decided, and it's the law of the land. And we need to recognize that and live within the constraints and the boundaries set forth by the Supreme Court in that case. Now, these people who want to repeal it, of course, have a viewpoint that's inconsistent with mine. Frankly, I'm not going to agree with the Supreme Court that a woman has a constitutional right to abortion, and I don't support abortion. Frankly, I don't know anybody who supports abortion. But I do know people, including Edwin Edwards, who feel that if a woman is raped or she's pregnant from incest or her life is in danger, then she and her doctor and her religious advisor should decide what to do about that. Not the government, not Edwin Edwards, not the Republican Party, and not the Democratic Party. That's too precious and serious a matter for a woman, and I don't want to interfere with that. But after we pass that thing, then I'm for shutting everything down, because I think that's an opportunity that a woman who is pregnant under those circumstances should decide for herself with her doctor and her religious advice.
What if the woman is 17 years old and doesn't feel like she's ready to raise a child? Should she have the opportunity to have an abortion if she chooses in that case?
Under the law, she has that option within the first 3 months. Now, I'm not prepared to say that that's right or wrong. My wife is very, very against abortion of any kind. She feels like even if her life was threatened, she would not want to have an abortion. I just think that a woman ought to decide that for herself.
This week, the governor of Louisiana went to the Mexican border with Texas to thwart illegal immigrants from leaving Mexico and coming to the United States. That is an issue, of course. It has federal significance. If you were governor, first of all, would you be down at that border doing the same thing?
I would go down to the border, and I would certainly want to inform myself as much as possible what should and can be done. Clearly, I think everybody agrees the border needs to be secured, whether that takes the Army, the Navy, the Marines, the National Guard, or state police, whatever, the border should be secured. Having said that, we have to recognize that there's some 12 million people in this country who may or may not be here legally. We need to find out those that are not and work with them to try to give them an opportunity, not just give them a citizenship, but give them an opportunity to earn one, because those people belong to churches, they have jobs, they have families, and they have become not American citizens, but American residents through the years. As far as the children that are there now, that's a different thing. I would do this. First of all, most of those kids have either siblings or parents or relatives in this country who may be willing and able to adopt them, and we ought to make that possible to get the burden off of the taxpayers of this country. Second, I think we ought to deal with the countries from whence they come and tell them if they don't close their borders and prevent the exodus of these children coming into America, that we're going to take the children when they get there, treat them fairly and decently, and then gradually bring them back to their country of origin. But the cost of that is going to be paid for by the country that let them out in the first place. And how do we do that? Because all of these countries get aid from America, and we've just taken out of the aid that we've been giving to them. And I think ultimately that will begin to solve the problem, because they will see that it is not practical or reasonable for them to continue that practice.
You have also been reticent to send U.S. troops to foreign outposts in times of war. You think that should be a last option rather than a first option? Why so?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand.
As far as military intervention abroad, for example, should the U.S. be in Gaza right now? Should it be in Syria? Should it be back in Iraq full-fledged or in Afghanistan? What do you think?
Well, I certainly don't think we should be in Afghanistan. We've been there over 12 years. Over 5,500 young men and women have been killed there. Over 50,000 have been badly and severely injured and will suffer for the rest of their lives. Once Osama bin Laden was killed, as he should have been, our business there was over with, and we should have come home. We're spending billions of dollars there building bridges, roads, schools, and other infrastructure for a country that doesn't appreciate us, has no use for us, has a different religion, treat their women and children like dogs. And as far as I'm concerned, I would leave them to their own devices. Five countries have tried to conquer that country since the birth of Christ. including Russia, which is on its border, and nothing has come out of it. It just doesn't lend itself to that kind of occupation.
We're visiting with former Governor Edwin Washington Edwards. He is now a candidate for Congress, and the election day, November 4th, is less than 100 days away, less than 3 months from today. If you'd like to talk with the governor, 297-5633, 877-217-5757. Now, Governor, you're trying to go back to Washington as a congressman 50 years after you first arrived. If successful, you'll be the last member of the World War II generation, the greatest generation to have served in either the House or the Senate on Capitol Hill. Why at this stage of your life have you gone this direction?
You know, this past Monday was the 100th anniversary of the beginning of World War I when Germany entered Belgium. It was a war fought to end all wars. It killed 14 million people from 28 different countries. And ever since that time, there hasn't been a decade of peace. We've got to find a better way to resolve our problems than going to war and killing people. Now, I was there in 1965 through 1972 until I became governor. I know the workings of Congress. I know how to get along with people. I can enter into principled compromise rather than this gridlock and stalemate that's in Washington now. I told somebody the other day who asked me about that, I said, look, I'm not going to promise you that I'm going to go up there and make things better. I'm going to certainly try. But one thing is certain, I can't make it any worse.
Things are a bit different, though, than they were in 1965 or 1972 when you left to become governor of Louisiana. Richard Nixon was the president when you left, and, of course, 40 years ago this week, he resigned the office. What do you see as the principal differences between then and now?
Well, the principal differences, I think, is that both parties, the Democrats have an unusual amount of influence for people on the far left, which is not good for the country. The Republicans have an unusual amount of influence from people on the far right, the so-called Tea Party people, who actually don't want any government at all. They don't want to shut everything down. But they never address the problems or tell us how they would do that or what they would do about Social Security or aid to farmers or weather forecasting or the Center for Disease Control, which tries to keep us safe from diseases and dread maladies. They never tell us what they would like government to do. They have these trite statements that shut government down, trim government, smaller government. What do they want to do? Cut the budget in the Defense Department to where we might be exposed to danger? I would like to hear from them rather than these statements about smaller government or less government. How they propose to accomplish that? What do they propose to cut? What are they going to shut down if they're given the opportunity? My point is this. Between those right-wing extremists and those left-wing extremists, and we have them in both parties, there's a large group of Americans who are decent, honorable people, including Republicans and Democrats and independents, who want government to work, who want to keep this country secure, and who want to take care of those in need, and also to provide a stable environment for businesses to thrive and for people to pursue their professions, their jobs, and their desires as to how to live their life. And that's what America has been about and should be about. We're the land of the free, not the land of the less than free, not the land of the imposed rules unnecessary on human behavior, but rather to allow people to live their lives and come and go in freedom without disturbing others.
We're hearing the voice of Edwin W. Edwards, Democrat from Prairieville, by way of Crowley, by way of Marksville. He's been on the Louisiana political scene now for more than a half century, and he's trying to return to Congress after, what is it now? He left office as governor in 1996, so that would be 18 and a half years, 19 years since he served the people of Louisiana. And, of course, some things happened in between. We'll talk more with Edwin Edwards after this 90-second timeout on 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Frank Barnett is producing. 297-5633, your number, inkstershow@wrkf.org. And we'll pass along some questions from listeners. This one from Hal in Mid-City, Governor Edwards, who is, of course, running for Congress and is our guest for a bit longer. Governor Edwards, would you, if you were governor, and it is a federal issue, would you take the federal Medicaid money that is spelled out under the terms of the Affordable Care Act? All right. I tell you what, Frank, we're going to have to see if we've got the governor. I think we may have, at least for a moment, lost contact with the man who led Louisiana from 1972 to 1980, and then, of course, he could not constitutionally run for a third consecutive term, so he sat out a term, won again in 84, defeating the incumbent David Treen, served 4 years, and lost to Buddy Romer, and then came back in 1991 and defeated Romer and David Ernest Duke. The federal Medicaid money, Governor, would you take the money if you were in the governor's office right now?
Would I do what?
Would you take the federal Medicaid money?
Well, of course. I mean, that is the most ridiculous thing that I've ever heard of. We have an opportunity to serve 300,000 old people, sick people, kids, unemployed people, underemployed people who need medical care. The government would pay for all of it for 3 years and up to 90% thereafter. It's not only a good deal financially, creating some 17,000 jobs in the paramedical field. It's a humane thing to do. People in 2014 should not suffer and die without adequate medical attention. Besides, for people in Louisiana, we need to understand that we're not saving anything by turning it down. The government is going to take the money they would have spent with for our indigent citizens, and it will be spent in Florida or Arkansas or Michigan or some other state that is wise enough to accept the aid. We're not going to save the government or ourselves any money by turning it down. We'll only create more misery and suffering for people in Louisiana who do not deserve to be overlooked like that.
297-5633, Barry in Mid-City. Good morning, Barry. You're on the air with Edwin Edwards. Hi, Barry.
Hey, good morning. Great show. Thank you for having the governor. And Governor, I wish you well in your race, and I appreciate very much what you said about Medicaid, but I'd like to ask you about your position when you are in Congress for Israel and the Middle East, please.
Your position on Israel and the Middle East, Governor?
Well, I have certainly supported Israel and will continue to do so. They're the only real friend we have in the area. They are a citadel of democracy and fair treatment for people, and they are surrounded by nations that have a desire to obliterate them from the face of the earth. America should stand firm and fast in support of Israel. I would continue to do that. I have met with the Jewish legation and have discussed that with them, and they're entirely satisfied with my position.
297-5633. Go ahead. Go ahead.
You know, if you are a Christian and read the Bible, you'll support Israel because the Bible predicts what's happening there. And I without regard to that, it's in our national interest to support Israel.
All right. Eric Thomas, who identifies himself as an LSU student, writes, how does Governor Edwards plan to get the vote of younger people like myself who grew up and formed political opinions while he was imprisoned? Fair question. What do you say to young people who know
that is
you?
A very fair question, and one of the problems I have in the race. People who are under 30 years old know very little about my real record as governor. I have a large group of LSU students, principally, who are serving as interns in the campaign, and we're going to do what we can to get the message out because I want young people to know about me. If they know about me and don't want to support me, that's acceptable. But if they don't know about me and don't support me, then that's not good for my campaign. I'm very proud of what I did. I think the fact that I got elected four times and in recent polls even do better than Jindal in an election, beating him 48-43, indicate that people were satisfied with what I did as governor. The budget was in balance. We had people working. I kept things running. I was here. I wasn't traveling all over the country. I wanted to be governor of Louisiana, and that's what I did. Let me close on this. In 1986, I wrestled from the federal government a $640 million settlement in a long-standing lawsuit. Didn't put the money in my pocket or give it to my friends, like some of my enemies like to say. I took $100 million of it and gave it a one-time raise to school teachers, bus drivers, and lunchroom workers. And I took $540 million and put it in a constitutionally dedicated fund for higher education. Every year since then, every university and college has received a windfall of money from that source. And you know what's good about it? Now the fund has grown to where it's $1.2 billion. That's a billion with a B. We're the only state in the nation that has such a fund, and I'm the only governor that ever left anything to the people of this state except unpaid bills.
All right.
I'm very proud of that.
All right. Final caller for Governor Edwards today, Jamie at LSU. Jamie, you're on the air with the governor. Go ahead.
Hey, listen, Jim, I'm no longer at LSU. I'm at New Roads. I've set up my campaign headquarters across from Satterfield. I'm running against you, Mr. Edwards. I'm best friends with Kevin and Dee Dee Riley. You've done a wonderful job for this state, but there's a lot better we can do, and I'm in touch with everybody that drives diesel trucks.
All right. Well, Governor, you do have an array of people running against you. Who do you think your most formidable challenger is?
Oh, I couldn't say that. I thought it was very interesting. Last week, a poll came out showing me with 35% against all nine of them, and the next fellow behind me had 12%. That's something like a 22% difference. I don't understand why none of these candidates have emerged as the leader. They go from anywhere from 2% to 3% to 4% to 12%, which is the highest in the polls. Now, I'm sure things will tighten up between now and the election, but frankly, I don't have any animus against any of them. I'm treating them all with respect because they deserve respect, and I admire the fact they're willing to put their names and personas out there to be criticized and get involved in a race. There are enough other people criticizing us. Those of us who are running and have that desire ought to respect the wishes of other people who want to run and let the voters decide who's the best qualified. Not the best looking, because I wouldn't make that, but certainly the most qualified, because I'm the only one who's ever been in Congress, and except for two of them who have a small amount of legislative experience. I'm the only one with any legislative experience of note and executive experience, and I know this state from top to bottom. I love the people. I love to serve. I want to be helpful. And let me tell you one more thing. When I'm in the Congress, if you need help, you can call me. I'm the kind of fellow who answers the telephone, and I'm the kind of fellow who addresses issues.
All right. Final question from a listener. Should a college degree be a necessity for a congressman?
No, there's no requirements at all for a congressman except that you be 25 years old. And
Should it be, though?
You do not even have to be a resident of the district in which you're running. Under Louisiana law, you're required to move in the district if you get elected. But the Constitution has only a couple of requirements for the members of Congress, and it must the surprise of many people, given my record. I am qualified under the Constitution. I'm going to qualify on August the 20th, and I will be on the ballot on November the 4th.
And you'll have a birthday tomorrow. How will you celebrate?
Well, whether you believe it or not, I have three political functions to attend, and I'm going to attend them. I'll be 87 years old, and I'm very happy to be that. I'm very grateful for my good health, and I feel like I still have much to offer. And Trina is very supportive, and I told a lady the other day who asked me if I was running on family values and said, yes, ma'am. Every morning at 6 o'clock, I get up and I feed my one-year-old baby. That's family values.
Well, thank you, Governor. Always a pleasure. Good luck
to
you.
All right, thank you.
Take care.
And good luck to all. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And we're joined in studio now by two gentlemen who do have college degrees, and lots of them, Drs. Albert Samuels and Thomas Miller from Southern University, the president and the vice president of the Faculty Senate, and they were listening with Ernest. In fact, both called the other day when President Ron Mason was on this show, and it is apparent that there is friction in Scotlandville, on the Bluff, at Southern University. Good morning to you, gentlemen.
Good morning,
Jim. Good morning, Jim. Good to be here.
Well, let's start with Dr. Miller, the president of the Faculty Senate. What's the beef with Dr. Mason?
Well, I was listening to the program Monday, and I did call in to say that there were many instances of misrepresenting what we know to be the truth out at Southern. We want to talk about some of that this morning. I think one of his one of the points that he was making on the show is that we were refusing to meet with him in public dialogue. But if I can elaborate on that just a bit, he has, in our experience, not shown an interest to dialogue with the Faculty Senate until very recently.
Well, we went through that, and I think we got both sides in, and now I think he is, whether he was or not in the past, he is eager to have dialogue, so maybe there is some progress on those on that front. So when you do talk, as I'm sure you will, what are the issues beyond public dialogue? What's the sticking point as far as you believing whether or not Dr. Mason is suited to be the leader of Southern University?
Well, I would refer back to a statement that he made on Monday, and that is that Southern is an institution of relationship as opposed to an institution of performance. And that is really gets to the heart of our our dissatisfaction with his tenure as president of the assistant president. And if I can just speak to that for a moment. He talks about Southern as being an institution of relationships, and yet he has brought with him from Jackson State a chief of staff, a vice president for academic and student affairs. He has brought with him his own counsel. He has just brought in a consultant at $17,000 a month to help produce a plan for moving Southern Baton Rouge forward, and I believe I emailed a copy of that plan to you. It was described by one of the board members as having no information in it that wasn't already known.
All right.
And so,
our governor, for example, has paid big money for consultants. Quite often, people, when they come to places, they bring people they've been associated with in other places. Now, right. Albert Samuels, is that a cardinal sin for Dr. Mason?
Well, you would at least expect that if someone would bring in someone at that kind of a salary, especially considering that we're supposed to be cash-strapped, that they could at least do a good job. And the report that was submitted to the board that basically proposes to consolidate the system and the Baton Rouge campus was put together so poorly. No high school student would turn it in. But we're wrong as faculty members for not using our training to critique this. And we have a consultant who meets with the faculty, who produces a poor report, and then has the audacity to tell the faculty, well, it's time for you all to stop complaining and get in line. And our universities are built upon the idea of academic freedom and exchange of ideas. And yet you don't want to have a free dialogue. You want to tell people they need to sit down and shut up, basically. So I'm sorry. I think, yes, I would expect someone to bring in a consultant, but you could at least do a good job.
All right. So what do you think Dr. Mason should do? He only has a year, I think less than a year left on his contract. Should he resign? Is that what you're asking?
One of the reasons that we don't have confidence in this administration is that they have consistently misconstrued what the problem at Southern University is. Southern University, and people know, has had some challenges, but we have an enrollment challenge. But we have enrollment challenges largely because of the policies of this administration. They have actually gutted the very organs of the university, admissions, recruitment, the registrar's office, financial aid, that are responsible for bringing in students. And then they pretend that they don't understand why we have an enrollment problem. And so when the president accuses the university of having a culture based on relationships rather than performance, it's precisely his performance that is at issue.
All right, so it sounds like you're calling for his dismissal. That's what it sounds like. Is that a fair statement?
Yes. Actually, we have called for his dismissal. We have called for his dismissal.
So you want him fired, like yesterday?
No.
Thomas Miller, you're smiling, but I had Dr. Mason on here the other day, and I can see why you might disagree with him, but he sounds sincere. He certainly got a background in higher education, and one thing that I did note that I think that is some common ground for you, the two sides, is that at this point, it's not a particularly good time to be a president of any university system in Louisiana. Is he also the victim of budget cuts to some extent?
I think to some extent it's fair to say that. But to go back to the revitalization stabilization plan that was put together by the $17,000 a month consultant, one of the board members made the comment after the presentation that there's not a thing in this proposal that every member of this board doesn't already know. Now, when pressed, Mason himself during that same board meeting would acknowledge that his proposal was not really a plan, and let's look at why. And this is where we're talking about failure of leadership. That path to revitalization and stabilization has no specific remedies. It has no implementation timetable. It has vague dollar amounts. He's supposed to save $2.2 million by combining the presidency with the chancellorship, but he doesn't tell where the savings are going to come from. LSU did that. I don't think they saved many dollars. And in fact, when you look at that consolidation, where is the money going to be saved? It's going to be saved in eliminating positions that are duplicated in the system in the campus level. But you can get there simply by eliminating the positions that have been duplicated at the systems level since Mason has been there. Now, let me just let me just say this one last thing. The fact that we did a critique of his revitalization stabilization path. He claims that it was full of errors, lies, and was intentionally misleading. And what he doesn't tell you is, in fact, we did have a plan. And our plan is in three steps. One, to eliminate all positions at the system level that are duplicated on the campus level, to get rid of all positions that are non-essential, and to bring
Okay, we got to pause, but we'll be back with Thomas Miller and Albert Samuels. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. A few more minutes with the president of the Southern University Faculty Senate, Thomas Miller, and the vice president, Albert Samuels. They are calling for the head of the man who's run the university system at Southern for the last 4 years, Ron Mason, who has a year left on his contract. He was on this show earlier this week and stated that he's unsure if he has the support from the Board of Supervisors to get a new contract, but certainly he plans on serving out his term, his five-year contract, and we'll see what happens after that. But Albert Samuels and Thomas Miller believe that President Mason has dropped the ball in his tenure at Southern University. Now, on the show the other day, he said that this Faculty Senate only has 13 members. Is he correct?
15, in fact, but it should also be noted that our student population is below what it was when Dr. Moore was Faculty Senate President. And the other thing is, it should be noted that we have a representative of every college on our campus in the Faculty Senate. So I think I mentioned the other day that we had a 70% turnout in faculty vote, which was probably a record.
Okay. John Williams writes, it was my understanding that when the legislature created Baton Rouge Community College, it was predicted it would hurt enrollment at Southern. LSU was raising admission standards, making it impossible for young people lacking strong ACT scores and high school academic success to get admission there, and legislators didn't want to force these students to go to Southern, where enrollment standards were not so rigorous. Not only did many white students choose BRCC, but so did many minority students. Is that an accurate portrayal of reality?
To some degree, that is true. But the issue that we've been raising with the president is that when you gut enrollment services, why are you surprised that you have a drop in enrollment? Our sister institution, Southern University of New Orleans, has 6 admissions counselors, and they are a small institution. We have 1 full-time person and 1 part-time person, and we have thousands of applications that have actually gone unprocessed. And so, but now you pretend that you don't understand why we have an enrollment problem when you have been responsible for making the cuts in enrollment services. So we are holding the president directly responsible for the situation.
As of the end of June, we had 5,000 applications to our university that were yet unprocessed. And it's simply a matter of not having had the staff in the registrar's office to process those applications. Mm-hmm. And that is the president is solely responsible for that. That was under his leadership that registrar's office was left gutted.
Now the good news about this is that what it also shows is that there is not a decline of interest in Southern University. The problem has been is that even in spite of all the budget cuts and some other things, people want to come to Southern. Our problem has been is that our leadership has not focus the resources where it needs to go. And instead, they have put too much resources at the highest level in administration. And now we're seeing the results of that. So that's what our problem is. It is, you know, he has failed in his responsibility to take care of the university.
All right, what's the next step? What's going to happen? Say at the next board meeting, are you going to make a plea for the board to fire him? What are you going to do?
Well, we've already had a unanimous vote of no confidence on President Mason, and although he dismisses that as just the opinion of a few disgruntled faculty members, I'd like to remind your listeners that is exactly what he said about the faculty of Jackson State when he was leaving, and their vote of no confidence, that it was just a few disgruntled faculty members. But I can assure you it's more than just a few who are unhappy with his administration over the past 4 years.
Charles on North Foster. Good morning, Charles. You're on the air.
Good morning, gentlemen. Good morning to you. Yes, let me say that I personally can attest to what they're talking about. I had a young lady who is a TOPS recipient who wanted to go to Southern, and it was quite a struggle to get her in. I was almost embarrassed at the difficulty that this very bright and talented student had with enrollment. I would also like to say that the Southern University Board cannot hire another president whose performance is not directly linked to his compensation.
All right. Charles, what do you think of his remarks?
Well,
to tie performance to compensation?
I totally agree with him, and I think it is an embarrassment, and that situation with the registrar's office, in fact, has been addressed in the past month. And why? Because finally, the campus has jurisdiction over that the day-to-day operations of that entity. And so we've, under Dr. Dumas's, Vice Chancellor Dumas's leadership, we've brought in faculty and students to help in the meantime. We've hired another person to go in the registrar's office. He's only been there 3 weeks.
All right. How long have you been at Southern, Dr. Samuels?
I've been teaching there since 1999, but I was a student in the 80s. So really, I've been associated with Southern in one form or another for about 30 years.
All right, and Dr. Miller?
Well, I'm family. I've been there this is my 19th year. I started in 1996. And speaking of Southern, if I can just say, I think all agree with Dr. Mason on is they are some outstanding programs. Nursing, he mentioned nursing, business, engineering, physics. We have 10% of all African-American PhDs in physics coming from places like Harvard, MIT, Stanford get their undergraduate at Southern. We have an environmental and toxicology program that is first rate, a pioneer programming in urban forestry, and we could go on.
He said, Dr. Mason did, that he thought Southern should emulate LSU and have the chancellor at the Baton Rouge campus also be the president.
You think I'll let Dr. Samuels address that.
The problem with that is that, once again, it misconstrues the problem. We have an enrollment crisis. We don't have an organizational structure crisis. And actually, the waste is on his floor. Consolidating those positions only maybe saves a couple hundred thousand dollars. The real waste is all the unnecessary positions at the system level. There's really not much to cut on the campus level. So we could save a whole lot more money by streamlining what the system does. But the Baton Rouge campus needs someone who is singly focused on the Baton Rouge campus. And so he has continually misconstrued the problem.
All right. Should LSU play Southern in football?
I would hope not, because they're going to, you know, because they're going to kill us.
Well, LSU's going to kill UL Monroe, too. But LSU plays every other school
except for Southern and Grambling.
Why are Southern and Grambling excluded from the LSU schedule, and UL Monroe and McNeese and Southeastern? Well, I haven't played Southeastern yet, but
when you think about the BCS BCS or whatever it is that's going to replace the BCS afterwards, you know, it sort of matters who you play, and you know, Southern getting beat 9-0 by LSU doesn't help them in those ratings when at the end of the year.
Well, it might not be 90-0.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, gentlemen. Albert Samuels, political scientist of renown, fired up about the leadership at his university, and we shall see how this plays out. But sounds like it's going to be quite an interesting year of intrigue, and we shall follow it right here with you. 297-5633. We're joined now in our remaining moments by Bob Jacobson. He's president of the Louisiana chapter of the American Society of Civil Engineers, observing its 100th anniversary. The centennial celebration will be held Saturday at the Renaissance in Baton Rouge. And good morning to you, Bob Jacobson.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning. I just enjoyed the conversation with the folks from Southern. Point out that ASCE formed its student chapter at Southern University in 1971. So we do know the civil engineering students at Southern University very well. They're very active, and we appreciate all the fine work that's done there at the Civil Engineering Department.
43 years ago.
Yes, sir.
It'd already been around for 57 years, but some of the structures that the ASCE is responsible for, the Huey P. Long Bridge.
Well, we like to think our profession has been one that people in the state can very much be proud of. Some of the projects over the course of the last century plus are outstanding examples of civil engineering, not just here in Louisiana, but across the country and internationally. When you look at issues of flood control, structures like the Superdome. The Superdome's going to be almost 40 years old this year.
40 years next year.
And unlike the Astrodome, hopefully it will never be bulldozed down.
Well, it is taking a licking and keeps on ticking. There's no doubt that the Superdome has been through hell and back. And Richard Sexton, the photographer, says it's one of the most beautiful facilities in our state. It's certainly symbolic.
It gets prettier every year. I remember when it was built. I was in there in the summer after it was built, and it's a tremendous asset. But just like the dome and our role in those types of civil engineering feats, everybody in the state, I think, has a favorite bridge. When you look at the Mississippi River, we've got 11 bridges, all of them pretty well known, and some of them some very striking examples of civil design work. So,
well, the new bridge in Baton Rouge is now 40-some years old, right? 42. And do you know the name of the new bridge, by the way?
I just still refer to it as the I-10 bridge. But
Wilkinson Bridge.
Is it the Horace
Wilkinson? So off to Horace Wilkinson.
Do you know the name of the Luling Bridge?
I don't.
That's the Hale Boggs Bridge.
Okay, I should know that. Named after the former congressman who died mysteriously in 1972 in October, and is the father of Cokie Roberts, sure, and the husband of the late, great Lindy Boggs. But yes, the Hale Boggs Bridge. We like to name our structures after people. And after
sometimes design. We call them the bridge to nowhere temporarily until we get some other development on the other side.
And we name these structures after people when they die. So sometimes we get in through the back door, like Bennett Johnston. He's a junior, so he got a Bennett Johnston Senior building at one point. There's a Milford Wampold Senior Park near LSU in honor of Mike Wampold, who is the son, but named after the father. I think that's how it works. But at any rate, the Causeway, for example.
Exactly.
That's one of the great modern lessons in civil engineering. And when I say modern, we're talking
late 50s.
Yeah, that's
56, last, I think it
lasted,
was.
Half, well, 60 years almost.
Well, I can recall driving across it when it was still just the single span in the early 60s. But yeah, we dedicated a civil engineering monument out there at the north shore of that bridge with the commission last fall. It's been designated a National Engineering Historic Landmark. And yeah, it was a premier effort in the end-on construction techniques that were developed for that bridge. So.
Well, the Saturday ceremony will reveal the Louisiana Centennial Award recipients in 15 engineering categories selected from 46 finalists. Can you give us a preview? Do you know who the 15 are?
I wish I did. It's going to be kind of exciting. We're going to open some envelopes and declare some winners, but hopefully we'll have a good representation of folks from across the state there. We have some really outstanding projects in the northern part of the state as well. For those of your listeners that hail from the Shreveport area, the McNeil Pump Station, folks don't know that the city of Shreveport was one of the forerunners in the country in the development of technologies for water treatment. And that pump station and the ancillary facilities associated with it were some really early examples of fine water treatment technology in the state. So it is about bridges and roads too. The other outstanding project that a lot of folks don't realize sometimes when they're driving in between here and New Orleans is when they drive through the Maurepas Swamp area. There was probably something on the order of 1 million yards of sediment that were dredged up from the Mississippi River to create the base for that roadway. And of course nowadays we're talking about dredging sediments from the Mississippi River for even other important purposes like coastal restoration, which is something our profession's very much involved with.
We're talking to Bob Jacobson. He's president of the Louisiana chapter of the American Society of Civil Engineers, and we're talking about some of the fine structures in our state. And a listener, Eric, notes that we did not mention the state capitol.
Oh, the state capitol is on our list.
Or One Shell Square, which is the tallest building in Louisiana.
Both of those are on our list, along with the Superdome, as finalists in the category of buildings. I can recall the construction of what's called the Plaza Tower building down in New Orleans as the earliest high-rise building, but really One Shell Square and obviously the state capitol as well are both finalists for the structure category, along with the Superdome. So, yes. Both outstanding examples of
the state capitol is a beautiful building. Some beautiful things through the years have not happened there, including the assassination of one Louisiana governor. But it's a building that's synonymous with our state and our city.
The local branch nominated Tiger Stadium. It didn't make the short list by the committee that reviewed it, but they nominated. Obviously, it has some very interesting
Tiger
characteristics.
Tiger Stadium did not make it, and the Superdome did? Now, that's heresy.
That's, you got to consider 40% of our members are from New Orleans, though.
That's heresy. Tiger Stadium's been around a lot longer than
the Superdome. If age was the sole characteristics, I think it would.
And the Superdome is no longer even close to the capacity of Tiger Stadium, which now has 30,000 more seats than the Louisiana Superdome.
I think we could have made a good case for Tiger Stadium.
Well, I think Tiger Stadium should have been on there. Another listener, obviously from the New Roads area, Jonathan asks about the bridge, the John James Audubon Bridge. Is it on your list?
It is certainly a finalist in, I think, the category of some innovations with regard to the cable stay construction. So it is a finalist.
And another listener asked about the Jimmy Davis boondoggle, the Sunshine Bridge. Did it make it?
No, it didn't make the list because really when you look at the nature of the design of that bridge, it really was kind of an extension of some of the other design techniques that were already well established at the time. But certainly the Huey P. Long Bridge in New Orleans did. John James Audubon Bridge and the Hale Boggs Bridge are all examples of some very remarkable advances in bridge technology here in the state. So those three are on our list.
And I got another inquiry about military bases. Any of them?
Yes, absolutely. Barksdale Air Force Base is a remarkable project for an industrial type facility. The other one I'd like to point out is the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. Folks don't realize that the salt domes and the excavation of those salt domes to store many months of oil, petroleum. Some of those caverns are, you could put and stack the Sears Tower two or three times inside of those caverns. So we've got some things that sometimes you don't even see that are worthy of note.
What about nuclear facilities?
Yes, the Taft facility, the Waterford 3 facility is an industrial facility.
It's on your list? It's nominated?
It is a finalist along with the Loop facility, and Port Fouchon and the Port of New Orleans are also nominated.
All right, well, this is Saturday night at the Renaissance for people who are hearing you and want to be there to
hit our website.
Which is?
LASCE.org.
LASCE, Louisiana
Association. Civil Engineers.
There you go.
.org. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you, Bob Jacobson. And we shall return tomorrow for Frank Barnett. I'm Jim Engster. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.